Accession number 12224, Real One.
Real One. So if I could ask you first of all, Pip, about your life, you know, this would be before the war, your family and the sort of background you had.
Well, I had one younger sister, 2 years younger, and I live with my mother and father in Brentwood in Essex. I was at Brentwood High School. I became a pacifist when I was 15 after hearing a talk given at the Congregational Union annual conference. And from then on, I regarded myself as a pacifist. And I was quite enthusiastic about it and had discussions at school and was always asking people about pacifism. I remember talking to the Labour League of Youth when I was about 15, 16, I could have been 17, about pacifism, and they, on the whole, were fairly militant.
I gather your family weren't friends.
My family belonged to a congregational church, and I was a member of a congregational church at that time.
Did you know anything about World War One?
Yes, my father was in World War One, although he became a pacifist in the 30s. And he had a lot of stories about the trenches in World War One, and he talked about it quite a lot, particularly when I was younger. I think my mother got rather tired of this, and he tended to do it less as he became older. He lived till he was 97. He died, in fact, up here. My mother, who is now 96, is still alive here. And I am 70 now. At the beginning of the war, I was 18. Now, on my 17th birthday, I started a group of FOR in Brentwood. That's the Fellowship of Reconciliation. I started that simply because I was a year too young to join the PPU. And on my 18th birthday, I joined the PPU and was in a local group in Brentwood.
What was it about that sermon that made you a pacifist, do you think? You know, would you have been just ripe for it at that time?
Probably, yes. I was a socialist and a Christian, and it seemed to me a very un-Christian to go killing people, that it was never right to kill people for an idea, and in the end it never worked. I don't know whether I can say much more about how I felt then, because it seems such a very long time ago.
Were there other people around you, other young people, who, you know, felt like you, or were you sort of one?
I was very much one on my own at school, and in the church, but there were just a few of us. And once we made an FOR group and then a PPU group, there were a dozen of us, and we were very intimate, I think, and very friendly with each other.
How easy was it to form your own FOR group? Were you sort of, did you have advice from the main body? Did anyone
yes,
help you?
Yes, yes. I think I did. I think there was a young people's group of the Congregational Church, and we had a speaker from the FOR whose name I cannot now recall, and I thought that I would work for them, and as soon as I was old enough, I did.
How did that differ from the PPU?
Well, it was very strongly Christian-based, whereas there were quite a left-wing element in the PPU as well. And the PPU, I think, was a little more militant. But I went to a lot of PPU meetings and FOR meetings. My diary is full of meetings all over London, because when I was 16, I worked in London in the post office headquarters. And I think At the end of the first week after war was declared, I was evacuated to Harrogate with the General Post Office. I was in the Accountant General's Department, and I spent the next 3 years there, 3.5.
Did you know anything about international events? You know, you were saying
Yes.
that you were a socialist.
Yes.
What was going on
Yes.
in Germany?
I did. I'd been on one visit to Germany. I'd been to Austria and to Switzerland and France before the war.
When would you have gone to Germany?
1935. I was 14. I was aware of the Nazis. It was a holiday run by the Congregational Union, and I did not realise it at the time, but in fact I think it was very closely in conjunction with the Nazis. I would think it was now. We had a brown shirt leader who sort of took us places and came round with us, and I'm pretty sure that it was. But I certainly didn't realise it at that time. One of the people who was on that group was, in fact, the week after we left. He overlapped by a week, and I think he was arrested as a mistaken identity, and it was a bit unpleasant for an hour or two.
Arrested by the Germans?
Yes, because he looked like somebody they were looking for. But Germany was sort of clean and tidy. I was in fact very politically conscious, quite young. I attended WEA classes in current affairs as soon as I started working in London, and I was at that time fairly knowledgeable about what was going on in Europe.
Yes, I suppose you would have had memory of the sort of depression of the 30s period.
Yes, I remember the 30s and the depression. At that time, until I was 6, we lived in London, and I can remember a man who walked all the way from Wales, and my mother invited him in and gave him a meal. And I was also conscious of the Jarrow March at the time it was going on. I think they stayed in Brentwood for a night. But at that time, my parents were much more interested in the church, and I knew they had been there, and I had several older friends who were involved with feeding them in Brentwood. I was aware of the depression. My father always kept a job. I don't think he was very well paid, but he always worked. He worked as a commercial traveller. For a stationer, a firm of stationers called Arnold's. And he was never without work, but it was dependent on commission, and I think often he got very little. But we lived in a very nice house in Brentwood with a very nice garden. My sister went to a training college for teachers during the war, and she became a teacher.
But when you went to Germany, you were saying in 1935 it was all neat and tidy.
Yes.
Yes. This would have been, I suppose, a year after Hitler came to power, would it be? He came in 1934, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, from 1933. Yes.
Were there signs of his sort of what developed as sort of his fascist system?
Well, I didn't see anything. I didn't see anything of it. But we were there on a holiday. We stayed in Düsseldorf, and we went to surrounding quite attractive places. We went to one Catholic church where they were feeding, I suppose they were beggars, but they were feeding people on a feeding scheme there, which impressed me.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, it's difficult really to judge Germany at that time objectively, isn't it?
Yes, I think I was too young to know the signs. I was 14. The following year, I went to Austria, And that was more interesting because I went by myself. I stayed with my school correspondent who lived in Vienna, and I was the only girl to go from the school. And I went alone on a 24-hour journey from Ostend. And I remember being very homesick. It was all very different, and I remember being rather homesick. But after a week or two, I really enjoyed that. I was there for 5 or 6 weeks, and I'm still friendly with that girl with whom I stayed. She went on to become a doctor. And I've stayed with her now several times since the war, although she has never been here. She has never wanted to come to England. I think she's rather frightened of travelling quite so far.
Were there any signs of German influence as early as 1936, do you think?
Yes, there were. For instance, there had been... Wasn't Dollfuss murdered then? And the we used to call it the Karl Marx block of flats, but whether it was or not, I'm not sure. But there was a block of flats, of workers' flats, in the middle of Vienna with gunshot wounds there, gunshot wounds, and there had been some trouble. I think some right wing elements had attacked them, and I was very conscious of that. But the families with whom I stayed was very Catholic and very conservative, really. I think she still is.
Did you know anything, you know, as the 30s went on, Pip, about sort of the concentration camps and the treatment of the Jews? Were you aware of that?
I find it very difficult to remember when I was aware of it. Certainly during the war, but we had quite a few German visitors staying in our house, and we were very anti-Hitler, and they were always very pro-Hitler. But I did not realise until a couple of years later that in fact the songs that we sang were in fact very often brown shirt songs. We were given a German songbook called Deutsches Heimat or something like that, and I think several of those songs, like Schwarzbraun ist die Haselnuss, Schwarzbraun bin auch ich, refers to the brown uniform, but that did not occur to me at the time. This is the way, looking back on it when you're 14, 15, that things that you don't associate, which you can later. But I was much more politically conscious in Vienna and in the surrounding area. I was very keen to climb a mountain, and they took me to a farm where an aunt lived. And it was called Ercher, this mountain. And I was really quite appalled by the fact that so many people in the villages did not wear shoes and were so poor. We had brown bread with some German sausage in and no butter, and I found this hard, and I thought that everybody in Austria was very poor. Also, I was staying in Klosterneuburg, which was just a few miles outside Vienna, and on the tram ride into Vienna, on the Strassenbahn, we went past a sort of shanty town of corrugated sheets where people were living, and the conditions were really very primitive. And I was upset by this and always very indignant. I don't know if I can remember much more about that holiday. I enjoyed it very much. We walked a lot, we swam a lot in the Danube. I was very conscious of cemeteries. They had a great reverence for the dead, and we seemed to be quite often taking flowers and putting them on graves of various relations. And the family I stayed with was unusual. The mother was a teacher of mathematics in the high school, And the father was injured in the war, and he only had one leg, and he stayed at home and did the housework. So it was, for Austria, a very unusual family. But, of course, I was there in the summer holidays, and it seemed to me we spent an awful lot of our time storing up food for the winter. We would pick the apricots and berries and fruits from the garden, and they would all be bottled and jarred and stored for the winter. And they had very thick double glazing, it was really. They had double windows with about a gap of 6 inches or so between. I had a very happy time there, and I'm still friendly with several people I met when I was there. One girl that I was a friend of Waltraud, who was the girl I stayed with, was in fact a Protestant, and I have also stayed with them since. But she was very enthusiastic for Hitler, and we had a letter from them after Hitler, after the Anschluss, when Austria was virtually taken over by the Nazis. I had letters from one or two of them saying, you know, how they'd rejoiced and they'd been there waving, which I thought, yes, well, they have probably always felt like that. I think they did. Their country was poor, and I think they'd had a very rough time after the First World War in Vienna and the whole of Austria, and it was a very poor country. The rate of exchange for the pound was very good, and living there was very cheap. And when I go now, I find it very expensive.
You were saying that you were anti-Hitler in your family, which sort of implies that you knew something about the nature of, you know, National Socialism in Germany. Is that right?
Yes. I think I was aware that a lot of people were imprisoned for their beliefs. I remember having arguments with them. They would always condemn Russia and how dreadful Russia was, and I think I had slightly more sympathy for Russia. And they would always maintain that Stalin had killed far more people than they had imprisoned, you see. And I was never very sure about this, but I knew that they were also imprisoning people for their beliefs, people like Martin Niemöller and other Germans who I would quote at them, and I used to get very intense about this, I think. But on the whole, they were not very politically aware. They were, on the whole, much more Catholic.
So what was your reaction when war was declared? Can you remember, you know, the day?
Well, I remember peace marches, peace demonstrations, in and around London and Brentwood. I remember selling peace news on the streets in Brentwood, and I must have been 17 or 18 then, and not much sympathy for it, really. I used to talk about it and take it to the office, and as all my colleagues, most of my colleagues, were ex-servicemen, they had only recently introduced women into this branch in the civil service, so most of them were the age of my parents, and I was forever lobbying them and talking to them. I also remember collecting money for Spain. Some of the young people I knew had in fact gone to fight in Spain, and I collected money round the office for the Basque Children's Fund every month when we were paid, and I would go around collecting money and sending it off.
When the war did break out, were you aware that you might be involved, that, you know, in fact women might be conscripted and that you might be sort of directed into war work or service?
Yes, I was. But I don't think that frightened me. I had several of the PPU group, the young men, had in fact registered as conscientious objectors already. As far as I remember, conscription started just before the war. And one of our group was in that first group of 20-year-olds who had to register as a conscientious objector. In fact, he too was in the civil service, although nowhere near my department. And he did, in fact, stay there all the war.
How about your own situation regarding registration? Did you feel it was necessary for you to take that step?
Yes, I registered as a conscientious objector as soon as I suppose I had some call-up papers or was asked to register, and I did register as a conscientious objector. And I have found the letter that I had about it. Would you like me to read it? It's quite long.
Yes, it would be interesting, I think, to know what they said. Mm.
It's from the Ministry of Labour and National Service, Employment Exchange, Harrogate. Because I was evacuated to Harrogate at the beginning of the war. National Services Act, 1939-41. Dear Madam, with reference to your wish to register as a conscientious objector, I enclose a certificate of provisional registration, NS2, bracket W. While you are provisionally registered as a conscientious objector, you will not be liable to be called up for service in the Women's Auxiliary Services or in the Civil Defence Force. You appear from the particulars furnished by you to be in an occupation from which women will not, for the time being, be called up. Your case will therefore not be referred for hearing by the local tribunal so long as you remain in that occupation. But if any change occurs in the particulars which you have furnished about yourself, you should notify the change to this office forthwith. Should any change occur either in your occupation or in the arrangements at present in force whereby women are not called up from that occupation, you will preserve your right to make application to the tribunal. You will then be notified and given an opportunity to complete and return an application to the tribunal on a prescribed form, NS14. Yours faithfully, W.H. Pitt, Manager.
So did you ever change your conditions of employment then, you know, as...
Well, yes, in August 1943, I went into the Friends Ambulance Unit. A few months before that, a notice had come round to my civil service department saying that women would be released, a proportion of women would be released for nursing and other services, probably the armed services. And at that time, I applied for release. I can't think why now, but I was quite keen that I should have a job at the end of the war. And I was granted release, and I went into the FAU, I think, on August Bank Holiday Monday or Tuesday, 1943. I'd been interviewed beforehand. It had been quite a lengthy business and application.
Yes, how did you hear about it, the FAU?
I think I knew about the FAU as soon as it was formed. I remember meeting in 1940, the summer of 1940, I went for a cycling holiday in Scotland, and we went up to Glasgow, another friend of mine who was also a conscientious objector, and she subsequently went into the Land Army. And we went up to Glasgow, and on the train we met a couple of young men wearing PPU badges, and they were in the FAU in London. But I think I'd always known about it. I think I probably knew as soon as it was formed, probably through FOR or PPU. I think we had quite a good network of information.
Who interviewed you?
Angela Dorenzi Martin. I can't remember. There must have been somebody else, but I can't remember who it was. And I had a medical exam, I remember. And I can't remember the name of that doctor now, but I think Eric might.
Did you know much about, you know, Barmore and the work the FAU had been doing?
I knew about the camps in Barmore. Two of the girls from civil service in another branch from Harrogate had left the post office to go to that camp. It was Susie Carter and Marjorie Whittles. So I did in fact know quite a lot about it, and I visited various sections before I joined.
Did you get any idea of the proportion of women to men?
I suppose I knew the women had three camps. In fact, I did not go to a camp because I think they didn't have any more after about 42, or it could have even been 41. They only had three in Barmore, and after that they just took women in singly and directly. I started when I joined. I was living in Gordon Square for the first 6 weeks. And the door was opened to me by Sandy Parnis. I thought rather dressed up as a pirate. He was doing his orderly duty and he had a red scarf tied round his head.
You say you lived there. Were you literally living there?
I lived in Gordon Square for 6 weeks. Number 4, Gordon Square, which was the FAU headquarters. And there were one or two women living there, Hetty Bargen and... that name has gone, but I know quite well. I met her at the reunion, and I'm afraid that name has slipped out of my mind.
What were you doing there for these 6 weeks?
For those 6 weeks, I was working in the outpatients department at Hackney Hospital.
Would that be sort of clerical work?
No, I was nursing. I had in Harrogate... joined the Red Cross, or St John's, and I'd done 50 hours in the local hospital, so I'd quite some nursing experience before I went into the unit, and I think I'd done 2 first aid exams and a home nursing exam. I think I got a Red Cross medallion by that time. But at Hackney. I remember most rather poor people coming in for outpatients, skin diseases, routine sort of dressings for outpatients, which I think aren't done in hospitals anymore, but they were at that time.
Had you had any experience of the bombing, you know, the Blitz, which of course occurred at the end of 1940, didn't it? Were you involved in any way with that?
Well... when I went home, I was, because there was not much bombing in Harrogate, but I did, after all, live in Brentwood, and when I went home, sometimes we slept downstairs under the table, and in the passage, I remember, yes. Particularly at the beginning. I seem to remember Christmas 1940. We seemed to be sleeping downstairs on the floor, with our mattresses down in various places.
I was wondering, you know, things like that, and say Dunkirk, and the threat of invasion that occurred in 1940-41, wasn't it?
Yes.
Whether that altered your conviction at all?
No, I don't think it did alter my conviction. But Brentwood was in a restricted area. Perhaps because it was within 20 miles of Southend and the sea. And I had we all had identity cards, and I think because of where I was registered, I was allowed to go home. But I think there was some restriction on going to the coast and on going to Brentwood, where I lived. But I think that was dropped fairly early in the war, because it wasn't difficult afterwards.
When you went into the FAU, were you given sort of uniforms? Did women wear uniforms?
No. I was given 2 white overalls, I think, and I used to cross them one way the first day, and when it got dirty, I used to cross it over the other way, and then they were washed. I think that's all we had, and some nurses' caps.
The proportion of women, of course, was much smaller, wasn't it, than the men. I was wondering what the attitudes of the men was, you know, towards the women, how they regarded you. Would you say you were treated as equals?
Oh, yes, I think so. I'm trying to remember. Well, in London, there were just very few people sleeping in Gordon Square. As far as I remember, 6 or 10, something like that. And again, sometimes we slept in the basement in fairly cramped conditions. So the proportions of men and women in Gordon Square was roughly equal, I think. There were quite a few women there, probably more women than men. And then, I was in Hackney Hospital. But we had our meals in the Middlesex Hospital. Yes, we had. I think I had meals in the Middlesex Hospital, and I suspect that was overwhelming. I certainly had breakfast at Gordon Square, and I think I had lunch in the hospital. There were certainly a lot of men and very few women in the Middlesex Hospital, because it was one of their main London centres.
Was that difficult for you, to be in the minority like that, do you think?
I don't think so, no. I didn't find it difficult, no. I think it was the same in the PPU group. There was largely men, and I suspect in that group I was the only girl.